Chester Arthur, the 21st president of the United States, frequently lands on lists of the country's most obscure chief executives. Few Americans know anything about him, and even history buffs mostly recall him for his distinctive mutton chop sideburns. Most of the people who flock to Arthur's still-standing Manhattan brownstone are there to shop for Indian and Middle Eastern spices and foods, not to see the only site in New York City where a U.S. president took the oath of office. People pass by Arthur's statue in Madison Square Park without even knowing who he is. And oh, by the way, did you know that he was buried in Albany? Historian Scott Greenberger tries to change that in his new book, The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. Greenberger is also the co-author with Senator Tom Daschle of Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis, and is the editor of Stateline, a news website funded by the Pew Charitable Trusts. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Scott Greenberger to the roundtable this morning. Scott, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
At what point do you decide in your life that you want to take on a biography of our 21st president of the United States?
That's an interesting question. I can't say that it's something that I had always dreamed of doing since my childhood, but I was past, let's say, I guess I got the idea about 5 years ago. I was looking for a topic in American history that hadn't really been written before, and I was reading a book about President James Garfield and the Garfield assassination called Destiny of the Republic by Candace Millard, and that book is about the shooting of Garfield and the terrible medical care that he got, which almost certainly led to his death. But there's just a little bit in there, a few paragraphs about his vice president, Chester Arthur, and it notes that he sort of a surprise choice for the Republican ticket in 1880, and that he had a long career at that point as a machine politician in New York, was widely viewed as corrupt and unfit for office, and yet when he became president, when Garfield died, he surprised everybody and became a great reformer. In addition to that, Candace Millard also mentioned that that this transformation had been influenced in some part by about 24 letters that he got from a young woman in New York named Julia Sand, who just started writing him out of the blue, urging him to be a better person and rise to the occasion. I was just fascinated by that idea of this young woman in New York writing letters to the Vice President of the United States and then the President of the United States, very boldly urging him to do right. And so that's how I got into the story.
Before we get into that remarkable story and the surprise and the promising start as a politician, let's go to the background a little bit. Being where we are in the capital region of New York State, Chester Arthur looms large because he went to Union College in Schenectady,
right.
But also in my hometown of Greenwich, New York, which was then Union Village. His father was a pastor for many years. That house still stands of where he lived. And very formative years in our village outside of Saratoga.
He spent his entire childhood up to the point when he went to Union College, as you note, and then it was only after he graduated that he moved to New York City. But up until that point, he was born in Vermont, but as you note, his father, actually known as Elder Arthur, was a Baptist preacher, and he moved quite frequently from parish to parish because he was a very outspoken abolitionist. And at this period, even in the North, in the early to mid-19th century, that was not necessarily such a popular viewpoint, and he was very, very strident in his anti-slavery views, and in many cases that led to him being removed from his position and having to go on to a different congregation. So the Arthurs were in several different towns in that region of the country.
And spoiler alert, he is buried in Albany.
He is, yes.
Okay. Now let's get to the part of which really the meat of the book, of course, is that he had a promising start and yet was perceived as a hack in New York City. And really, as you said, not much was expected of him. How did that reputation come about?
Well, he did, as you say, he did start out well after shortly after he moved to New York City, and he was a lawyer working in the law firm of a friend of his father's, who was also an abolitionist. He was the lead lawyer in the case that ended up desegregating the streetcars in New York City. It was a very important victory, and in fact, the African-American community in New York City celebrated the anniversary of that verdict for years afterward. Also, during the Civil War, he served as quartermaster of the Union Army in New York City and was responsible for housing and equipping the troops who were going off to war. And this was, for a person who was not so honest, this would have been a terrific opportunity to line his own pockets. But by all accounts, Arthur served honorably and with integrity. It was really after the war, or toward the end of the war, when he had left his post as quartermaster, that he started down a different path. He had been fairly recently married, and he wanted to start making some money, and his wife had expensive tastes, as did he, and he recognized that the way to get ahead in the New York of that era was through politics, and the politics of that era was machine politics. This was the Gilded Age, and politics was really about gaining and perpetuating power, and for many people involved in it, also enriching themselves. And he went down that road, and for the next two decades or so, he rose through the ranks of the Republican Party machine in New York until he was the chief lieutenant of the boss of New York, whose name was Roscoe Conkling. And so by the time he ended up on the ticket in 1880, he really had become known as sort of the quintessential machine politician in New York. And the way he ended up on the ticket was that Conkling and his wing of the Republican Party wanted former President Grant to come back and serve a third term because Grant was considered to be friendly to Republican machines like the one in New York. And when the Republicans meeting in Chicago during the convention instead chose, after many, many ballots and a deadlock convention, chose Congressman James Garfield, they thought that they needed to give the vice presidential spot to somebody who was allied with Conkling, so Conkling would help them win New York in the fall, since New York was the most populous state in the Union at that point. And so they gave that spot to Arthur, figuring, well, Garfield's a young, healthy guy, and vice president doesn't do much anyway, and this would be an easy way to win Conkling's support. So that's how Arthur became known as a machine politician and how he surprisingly ended up on the national ticket.
So at the time as vice president, when he then becomes president, it's amazing of how quickly, as you note in the book, that pretty much from the moment that he took office, he proved that he was going to be very different, and he would be honest, and he would clean house.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to remember that Garfield was shot in July, July of 1881, but he lingered on what would end up being his deathbed throughout that summer. And I think that had a tremendous effect on Arthur, just seeing the effect of that political violence on country, and also the fact that many people in the press accused Arthur and Conkling of somehow being involved in the assassination, and that very deeply wounded Arthur. And I think the other thing, and I alluded to this earlier and I talk about a lot in the book, is that towards the end of that summer, shortly before Garfield finally succumbed to his wounds, he got the first of what would be two dozen letters from this woman, Julia Sand, really urging him to return to his younger, idealistic self and to rise to the occasion, and reminding him that while as a machine politician in New York and even as vice president, he could perhaps afford to be loyal mostly to his faction of the Republican Party and to his friends, as president of the United States, he had much larger responsibilities, and he seemed to take that message to heart.
Tell us a little bit about Julia Sand and the large role that she played in his life.
So Julia Sand, when she wrote the first letter to Arthur, was 31 years old. She lived in Manhattan in New York City. She was what we would call now a political junkie, but this was a time when women couldn't vote, let alone run for office or be really involved in politics. And so though she followed politics closely, she didn't really have an outlet for that interest. And she also suffered from some kind of vague kind of Victorian illnesses. She had some sort of spinal pain and some other things that left her largely housebound. She was not married, married and lived in the home of her brother, Theodore Sand, who was a banker. And she just took an interest in Chester Arthur. Clearly, judging from her letters, she had followed his career closely, knew a lot about him, and was bold enough to write these letters to him. Pretty extraordinary when you think about it, that this woman would just start writing these letters to the vice president, and then the president of the United States giving him political advice, telling him he had to be a better person, that he needed to rise to the occasion, that history would be judging him. It's really, their letters are really extraordinary.
One of the big accomplishments that you write about is civil service reform. Why was that important, and why ultimately, and you write about this in great detail, as to why it was such an accomplishment?
Well, it was civil service reform was really the hottest political issue of that era. Garfield had been shot by a man named Charles Guiteau, who was a disappointed office seeker, a guy who thought that as a result of his work for the Republican ticket during the 1880 campaign, that he was entitled to a federal job. And in fact, he thought he should be ambassador to a European country. I mean, he was clearly mentally ill and had a lot of problems. He was insane, but that was the sort of the immediate impetus for his act. And it came at a time, this act of political violence, when people were concerned more broadly about this system that we had created called the spoils system, under which almost all federal jobs or a large portion of them were handed out to people who were loyal to the party. And in fact, once they got those jobs, they were required to make campaign contributions. It was all about perpetuating the power of the political party instead of hiring people who actually knew how to do their jobs, who were qualified, who had the education to do their jobs. And so many reformers in the Republican Party and outside of it during this period felt that American democracy really was threatened by this, that if the federal government was just filled with people who were party hacks, and it largely was under the spoils system, that it was corrupting American government, and that it would be difficult for the federal government to be effective and to achieve its goals. And also there was a lot of a worry at the time about the influence of large corporations and extremely wealthy individuals who were using their money to influence the political process. This combination of that phenomenon and the fact that so many federal jobs were occupied by people who were just party loyalists, it was a very dangerous situation for the country, and people were very concerned about it. And so the idea of civil service reform was that instead of hiring people simply because they were loyal to the party, that you would hire people who actually were qualified to do the job.
You do say in the book, I mean, obviously you talk about these accomplishments and the things that he did. Obviously, he made a lot of enemies along the way. He did not run for a second term. Talk a little bit about that decision, which I guess was mostly health motivated. But what was his popularity at that point?
Well, it's interesting because when you read the newspaper accounts of the time, many people were very impressed with his administration by the end of it. Mark Twain, in fact, who certainly was not reluctant to criticize politicians, said that it would be very difficult to better the administration of Chester Arthur. So he had some fans, but at the same time, he didn't really have a natural constituency in the Republican Party because he had alienated all of his old machine buddies. They thought he was a traitor, and the reformers still didn't completely trust him. They couldn't really get beyond his past, and so he did not have sort of a natural base of support. And then also, as you say, he was secretly suffering from Bright's disease, a kidney ailment, which weakened him, and he feared that he might not survive a second term. But given all that, I think it seems to me that he would have welcomed being nominated again, but wasn't really willing to push hard enough for it to do the things that might have helped his chances of winning the nomination. So I think it was a combination of factors that led to him not being the Republican nominee again in 1884.
And final question, in your research, and you just touched on this, but in your research, why don't we know more about him? Why has he not risen in any way to our knowledge of presidents?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. The first one is the era in which he lived. I think a lot of in school, just speaking from my own experience, I think this is true of a lot of American kids that in history class you learn, you certainly spend a lot of time in the Civil War, you talk a little bit about Reconstruction, but then you pretty quickly sort of fast forward to Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives and World War One. So it's an era of history that's a little foggy in the minds of most Americans, though I think it shouldn't be, because it really is the period of time, the 1870s, 1880s, where you sort of see modern America taking shape. You know, as I mentioned, you have incredibly wealthy individuals for the first time, the Vanderbilts and Jay Gould, who people making a tremendous amount of money from the railroads, the robber barons, huge corporations, the trusts that Teddy Roosevelt would take on. All of this starts to take shape during this period. So even though it's a period that is often ignored, I think it's very important. The other reason I think that he's not remembered is that he was so ashamed of his career prior to becoming president that he ordered almost all of his papers to be burned, with the notable exception of the Julius Sand letters, which are still at the Library of Congress. And therefore, I think it's been difficult for historians to really get a sense of who he was and what he did, because there wasn't a lot of there weren't a lot of documents available. And so for my own book, I had to rely very heavily on the observations of people who were around him, who did write memoirs, and also the newspapers of the time, which fortunately the writing in the newspapers of the time was very vivid, because people, most Americans, had never seen the president or heard the president. So the descriptions were very detailed. And also because his story takes place largely in New York and Washington, there was plenty of press coverage and plenty of newspapers to consult. So I think those two reasons, just the fact that the period of time is a little unfamiliar to most Americans and the fact that he burned his papers, those two things combined have resulted in many Americans not knowing much about him.
The book is fascinating. It is entitled The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester Arthur. It is published by DeCapo. Scott Greenberger, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been fun.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, The Unexpected President. It's published by DeCapo by Scott Greenberger. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.